Welcome to The Sound of Economics, a podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Giuseppe Porcaro, Head of Outreach and Governance.
And I'm Guntram Wolf.
And I'm Maria De Mergis.
I am Simone Tagliapietra.
And in this episode of The Sound of Economics Live, we will dive deeper into the EU Recovery Fund, currently being designed by the European Commission. As usual, for the listeners who are following the live recording session, they are invited to participate and ask questions on Slido. This week, the President of the European Commission, in a speech at the plenary of the European Parliament, sketched the thinking about the next EU budget. The first pillar will focus on supporting member states to recover, repair, and come out stronger from the crisis. The bulk of the money will be spent within this first pillar on a new recovery and resilience tool. The second pillar will be about kickstarting the economy and helping private investment to get moving again. They propose to strengthen InvestEU to create a strategic investment facility and a new solvency instrument to help match the recapitalization needs of the healthy companies who have been put at risk as a result of the lockdown. And finally, the third pillar will be about to strengthen programs that have proven their value in the crisis, such as RescueU or Horizon Europe, as well as a new dedicated health program. Guntram and Simone, you are the co-authors of a paper published by Bruegel that argues for a rethink of allocation of spending priorities in the EU budget and highlights the need for a joint borrowing to smooth the effects of the crisis over time. How do the words of the President of the Commission resonate with your thinking? And could you explain to our listeners what is your vision for this recovery plan?
Yes, so thank you, Giuseppe, and welcome to all of our listeners today for also this podcast from my side. I mean, let me perhaps start by saying what the president said. The Commission president said is, of course, not yet concrete, and I think in the end we really need to see the numbers and what exactly the Commission wants to do, and then, of course, what the member states will agree to and what the Parliament, the European Parliament, will agree to. And politically, of course, there is now a big fight, not just between countries, but also between the European Parliament and the member states. I think the European Parliament was quite disappointed, to put it politely, by how little they had been involved in the debate so far, and they have called for a major borrowing facility, and I think the number they mention is 2 trillion. I think it is important to understand that at this stage, there is really two debates ongoing in parallel. There is a macroeconomic debate, and then there is a microeconomic debate. The macroeconomic debate is mostly about borrowing. So how much will the EU, the European institutions, borrow in financial markets and then pass on to the member states? In our paper, we argue it is absolutely important to borrow, because when you have a temporary big shock, you should smooth the consequences of that shock via borrowing, and that should be done at the EU level and to a significant extent at the EU level. And there's really two reasons why it has to happen at the EU level. The first is, again, macroeconomic. We have a fragile monetary union in particular, and it will be helpful to have EU debt to stabilize the monetary union. We can't just rely on the ECB. That, I think, is very clear to any macroeconomist, and we can discuss that and also the German Constitutional Court in that context if we want to further. But I think it's equally important to understand there's a microeconomic motivation, and the microeconomic motivation is really about making sure that we apply a coherent set of strategies, a coherent strategy on the rescues that are now ongoing for firms. So if all the borrowing happened only at the national level, every country would essentially implement policies according to their own liking, to their own preferences. And that would in itself lead to distortions in the single market, and even might even undermine competition within the single market. So in a sense, the microeconomic motivation, the single market, the integrity of the single market, the preservation of competition, I think is probably as important as the macroeconomic motivation at this stage. And so I think in that sense, the package and the headlines mention the right things. They mention the macro stabilization, they mention the reallocation of spending priorities, and they mention the need for some sort of an equity fund. But then the devil is in the details. I mean, these are perhaps my first reactions, but I'm sure Simone wants to add.
Yeah, first of all, thank you all for your attention. And indeed, the paper we published this morning aims at framing, at providing a conceptual framework, let's say, of what kind of economic recovery steps Europe will undertake over the next months/years. The way we frame it is basically into the economic recovery into three phases. The first is the emergency liquidity, which we have seen being granted so far by governments to both firms and workers. The second phase, in our view, should really relate to solvency support. And the third is, we of course characterize the end of this year, but then foremost 2021 will be about the rebooting of the economy. We think that there will be difficult trade-offs ahead, because policymakers will need, of course, to decide whether to have, for example, a quick and dirty, let's say, recovery, or rather a recovery that is also focused on the environmental goals. We policymakers will need to find out whether much should happen to national debt on the basis of national debt or EU borrowing, as Guntram mentioned. So there are difficult choices that will need to be undertaken in the near future. And in order to guide these choices, we came up with four principles, which in our view might help policymakers to navigate these uncharted waters. The first principle, in our view, is the one that only financially viable firms should receive support. And with financially viable firms, we don't only signify firms that were financially sound in 2019, that's of course a necessary prerequisite, but we also consider necessary to put in some evaluation about what will be the markets of the future, and where to identify clear societal goals. Because if we want a recovery to be green, for example, we could well expect companies to be active in the green field to be, of course, viable, because that's where the markets will go. The second principle is that the state support should not undermine the competition in the EU single market, and that's really where the counterbalancing nature of the recovery fund and also of this EU equity fund we propose come in, because we have seen that different countries in Europe have different financial and fiscal, let's say, fiscal power to support their firms, and therefore we need a counterbalancing mechanism at the European level in order to preserve the single market, which is in the interest of all, because it is in the interest of the southern countries, is in the interest of the northern countries, which are, like Germany, based on an export-led model, which basically needs viable markets that are there to buy the products after the crisis progressively vanishes. The third principle is that state should support should not undermine, but on the contrary, support broader societal goals. And we think that the priorities set by the European Commission the climate neutrality, social cohesion, even the digitalization of the economy, those are principles that should inform the recovery policies. Ultimately, the fourth principle is that taxpayers should receive their share in the rewards of the recovery. So we should not look at bailouts, but at investments. That's why we think that an EU fund, EU equity fund, is important, because it would allow further down the road taxpayers to retrieve a reward from the investments they currently made. So let's not focus on bailouts, but more on investments, which could therefore ensure the sustainability of this process. Those are the first principles we propose with this paper.
Oh, thank you very much, Simone and Guntram, for this very comprehensive summary of the paper, which is actually available on our website, www.bruegel.org. Continuing the conversation later a little bit to go in depth into these four principles and also the tools that that you are proposing. But before we are going to go a little bit more into the details of and the nitty-gritty part of this, I would like to ask Maria to give us her reflections on the ideas that we just heard, and but also like trying to tackle those both from a general point of view as well from a specific angle, because Maria also just published an opinion piece on our website around issues which relates to the very important aspects of competition and state aid and all the stuff that you just mentioned, Simone. And Maria, you have argued that with the relaxation of the state aid rules, the EU is rapidly moving from an even playing field that promotes the survival of the fittest to an uneven playing field where only those with the richest parents survive. Maybe you can both react to Guntram and Simone, but as well explain a little bit your take.
Thank you very much, Giuseppe. You've asked many questions, so if I may go back maybe at the beginning. First of all, let me just say that I recommend to our listeners to read this paper, because this is a paper that has a lot of information in it, and it has a lot that many people will agree with. And of course, there will be discussion points, and you know, my blog was very much also part of this attempt to have a discussion. But I think what the paper does very well is outlines the periphery of the scope that we should approach this issue of the recovery. And I think that's very important, because it gives us the tools to begin to think about this, to think about this problem. And Simone just outlined the I think the gist of the paper, which is the four principles, which are very important in my view in terms of guiding our thinking. And they give us an axis of how to begin to think about the solutions. I mean, Guntram said, I think, also something which I think is very important. The program that will come to us first from the Commission, the suggestion, and therefore whatever countries will agree, there are two things that we should be looking in there. First of all, the size. Can it make an economic difference? If the size is not big, it won't make an economic difference. So that's an important thing. So as Guntram said, the details are important here. And the second thing is the composition, if you like, the doses between what is going to be coming in the form of loans and what is going to come in the form of grants. And the discussion on this topic is important, because it will tackle this issue of not everybody being able to deal with the problem in the same way, because not everybody is as equally prepared. So I think these are the scope, and the paper does that very well, of thinking about the problem. Now, there are bits to it that, and I don't know if you want to go directly into this, perhaps I can start with this quote that you named. I mean, this relaxation of the stated rules is not the elimination of the stated rules, that's the relaxation till the end of the year, is effectively favoring those who have the power to save against those that don't have the power to save. And here, fiscal capacity, really, what we're talking about. And then the question is, who compensates for that? And as Simone said, I mean, some of this needs to be recaptured at the EU level, as we can, to compensate for inability to save at the national level, to do it at the European level, in order to preserve the integrity of the single market. So I think that's an important part. We need to reverse that process in some way, in order to be able to secure what was working very well and that is the integrity of the single market. But I think the paper does that. It's very much in line with what the paper says as well. I think one important thing that perhaps the paper doesn't say is that the state aid rules had always been an obstacle in us thinking about the global scene. Obstacle is a hard word. I appreciate that, but we are so hang up. We are so the state rules are so dear to us in terms of favoring fair competition in Europe. But they have prevented us from thinking about the future of role, the future role of Europe, of the EU, in the global context. So I think that for as long as those rules are relaxed, this is an incredible opportunity for us to also perhaps rethink how those rules need to be adjusted in order for the EU to also think about its global position.
So, Giuseppe, perhaps I can add one or two points, I think, which to the discussion, which I think will be very important. I mean, I think the first point to make is that I think we need to be of course, extremely careful in thinking about where we are in the different stages of this crisis. And I think the initial response was very much a response of pretty indiscriminate support to all kinds of companies. And all countries actually did a lot. And, you know, if you compare, for example, the Italian fiscal guarantees to the German ones, at least according to Bruegel estimates by our colleagues, Joel Dabasch, they look remarkably similar. But I think as we move on and as this crisis lasts longer, we will increasingly move into really the realm of equity support. And if you come to equity support, questions of ownership are extremely important, and questions of who gets the upside, who takes decisions in the companies, and who gets the upside in case after the crisis. And I think our key argument here is we need some upside for the taxpayer. Now, that cannot be a market-based intervention, because if it's a market-based intervention, then markets would do it. So there will always be some element of transfer to the company. But I think it's not acceptable that that you don't have an upside to the taxpayer in a situation like the current one. So that means you dilute the current owners. And as you do that, and if different countries do it to different degrees, then you can actually create distortions in the single market that can be significant and that need to be monitored very carefully. This is not only relating to fiscal capacity. I mean, fiscal capacity is one dimension. It also relates to societal goals. I mean, some countries might decide that they want to preserve particularly the coal industry, the car industries, the third one, the tourism sector. And as countries verse different amounts of money to different sectors, those sectors in those countries thrive and could actually take over ownership and capacity in other countries. Perhaps the last point I want to make is that's a bit of a defense of the strong fiscal response we've seen at the beginning. I think we should be very happy that countries have actually engaged in very big fiscal responses at the beginning. We should acknowledge that there are, of course, positive spillover effects of those interventions. So it's a bit ironic that some now complain that Germany has been doing so much in the last year, in the last months, and the same people have been basically complaining only half a year ago that Germany does too little to help macroeconomic stabilization. So I think we should be also a little bit careful just to say every intervention in Germany is bad. No, on the contrary, I think if Germany bails out TUI, a tourism company, well, that is not only beneficial to the workers in Germany. There's lots of workers directly related or working for TUI in other countries. And by the way, if it helps boosting tourism, it also helps other countries. So in a sense, we need to be very careful about when does a state support really become distortionary for the single market. For that, we need some rules. We need the Commission to monitor this. The Commission does do the monitoring, and I think they will have to continue to be very vigilant, because predatory purchases, because you have more fiscal resources, I mean, that would be unacceptable.
Simone, you wanted to add something.
Yes, thank you, Giuseppe. I actually wanted to just add a complementary point to what Guntram just said, giving another example of an industry in which there might be positive spillovers to other countries from state aid, for example, in Germany. And I think about the automotive industry. As you know, there are industries like automotive, which in Europe present a very integrated supply chain in different countries. And clearly, should a country like Germany support its automotive industry, that would also have positive effects, for example, on the suppliers that in Northern Italy or in the Czech Republic or in Poland supply components to the German industry. So there are positive spillovers that indeed should also be considered. I would like to make another point on the governance aspects, because while thinking about an EU equity fund that should notably be focused on small medium enterprises, which we know represent the backbone of the European economy, we of course had some thinking into how can we really make sure that this money would ultimately flow into the right companies. So should Brussels do that? Should Luxembourg through the European Investment Bank do that? In our way, the best option to build such a EU equity fund would be to put it under the control of the European Investment Bank, because the European Investment Bank is an important institution that has a long track record of such operations in Europe. But we think that such a mechanism, to be efficient and really effective, needs to bring on board the national promotional banks. So KfW in Germany, Cassa Depositi e Prestiti in Italy, and so on and so forth, which traditionally have worked a lot with their respective national small medium enterprises and know them. So that could be an important synergy. And ultimately, we also need to have commercial banks on board, because they have perhaps the best expertise to deal with companies. And therefore, what we need to do is to craft a very smart synergy between the European Investment Bank, national promotional banks, and commercial banks to make such a fund really effective.
Can I just add one sentence on this? Sorry to interrupt, but I think it's really important that the governance that we get the governance right, and that's not at all trivial. I mean, you cannot let politicians take decisions, because they are good in deciding on the big societal questions, but they are not good in deciding taking commercial decisions. So you need commercial investors. I think that's very, very important. And I think it's also very important that we have a clear definition of European societal goals. And there, I have to say, the EIB and other institutions, they really need a very, very clear guidance where the travel is supposed to go and what are the European goals they have to achieve. Otherwise, it will be very quickly a policy of juste retour, so every country tries to get as much as possible out of the EIB. I mean, that's not what we want. We want targeted support according to jointly set European goals. And I think that's very important.
Thank you. I would like to look a little bit on the questions from our listeners, because there are a few questions around the issue of state aid, and in particular, the issue of nationalization, which has been mentioned, but not so much into detail. I have a question from Nico that is asking if citizens will accept that sectors that providing basic services but now in difficulty are being nationalized now, but then they will become private again when they are profitable again. So basically, national. I mean, the old motto or the old big issue of nationalizing the losses and privatizing the profits, which when you nationalize losses, you always have an issue since it's taxpayers' money, and when you privatize the profits, is obviously yes good for certain sectors only, but it can provide some kind of questions within the citizens themselves, which have been paid for the losses.
The taxpayers cannot just pay for the downside. So if taxpayers go in now and actually support companies, the current shareholders need to take a hit, it seems to me. You can't just let the current shareholders get away with it, and because then you would really just transfer money to them. So I think it's actually important that current shareholders share the burden. And according to corporate finance, that does not hurt the company behind it. It just hurts the owners of the company. And and of course, the question is how much you want to hurt them. And I don't think it can be 100%, but it can't be zero either. So you need to find the right middle way. And I guess the other point is, but what does it mean if current shareholders get lose their shares? Who actually will take decisions in the company? And there, my view is, governments are not very good in taking commercial decisions. So governments will more be like silent participants in the company, perhaps with some say on some big societal questions. And that's the green conditionality that we discuss in the papers. So yes, I do think when governments come in, they can actually ask from companies to achieve some broader societal goals, at least to some extent. But the commercial decisions should not be done by state secretaries sitting in the board of the companies and then serving short-term political interests. I think that would be very dangerous.
In your paper, you mentioned another principle, which is not only basically giving money, but considering those as investments.
I mean, in this decision-making of who we are going to rescue and how we're going to rescue, there are three types of companies. There is those that are clearly productive. And those that are clearly productive, in my view, need to be assisted so that when we come down to the recovery phase, they're ready to go. So I would personally be in favor of assisting them in the easiest way, which is as close to transfers as possible. Because you will be asking those firms to drive the recovery. So you need them to be, they need to be at the point where they can do the most they can for the economy. So I would not burden them with the debt overhang that if you give them loans will necessarily do. So I would be very generous when it comes down to the productive firms. Then there is a second category, which is those that are clearly unproductive. And they should not be allowed to continue. They should be allowed to fail. And any societal help that you want to give needs to be on the unemployment side or help in retaining the unemployed. There is, however, a third category, and this is where most, I think, of the companies fall in, and they are the one in the middle who are not quite clear where they are. And actually, I believe that the principle of this indiscriminate support that we're giving right now is because it's very difficult to sift through the companies and understand where they fall. So we just help everybody. But actually, this is very costly. So we need to sort of, identify that middle category, which is actually the biggest category in EU. And what do we do about that? Who decides who needs to be saved and who not to be saved? Now, here I think that there are issues that, in my view, go a little bit against what the paper argues, because I don't believe, and here Guntram did say, that the state is not in the position to understand who is the right firm to save and who not. Perhaps banks could. I would argue that even banks are not in the right position, not in the perfect position. I think, big venture capitalists, capital markets are the ones who are capable and have enough, what we call in finance, skin in the game, to go in and sift through the risks and identify and therefore invest on those who are worthy to invest and take their necessary risks. You see, that I think is an important point. Now, Europe is not well prepared for this because we don't have well-developed capital markets. And therefore, we need to rely on all these second scale options, which is basically you need to involve the banks, you need to involve the investment banks, you need to involve the EIB. But I mean, it's important to remember that a productive company, a company that knows it's productive, in my view, will not accept a dilution of ownership. So it would not elect equity participation. They would prefer loans because, you know, SMEs only accept ownership dilution if they scale up. We're not talking about scaling up here. We're talking about saving. We're talking about surviving. So if they are productive, they will want a loan. If they accept equity and therefore dilution of ownership, probably means that they're not as productive. So they just basically take whatever they can offer. And I think this equity dilution will be counterproductive. So I'd be careful with this equity fund, how this is done. The last thing you want is an EU official in your board that comes in. And if they don't have who comes into the shareholders meeting, you say they don't have a vote. Well, yeah, they don't have a vote, but they have a share. And that dilutes decision making. So I think Europe is not well braced to do this, and this is unfortunate. So I would urge, and this is something that, you know, this is not the right time to say this, but perhaps it is. This is time to make progress, real progress on the capital markets union. We've procrastinated for 10 years, and now we really need the capital markets because we need them to shift through the risks that we are facing. The state cannot face that, and I dare say, not even development banks can.
If I may, as a reaction also to this point, I think one of the key prerequisites we outline as far as the participation of governments into companies is concerned also entails a timeline, a very clear timeline about the government exit from the company. So it's clear that the governments should not stay there forever. So there should be clear the idea that this is something temporary, this is something done out of urgency, and this situation should quickly come back to normal as the situation will normalize. And that's indeed the emergency element, what underpins this concept, because we totally agree with you, I totally agree with you that a very well-developed capital markets will be the first best in this context, but we need to face the reality we have in front of us. The reality in front of us is that we need to act quickly because the next months up to the end of the year will be defining for the future of the European economy. There is a risk of having a wave of bankruptcies. We cannot wait for the Capital Market Union to come. As you said, we have been discussing this for 10 years. We need a solution, an emergency solution that works immediately. That's why we see the urgency of a public private, let's say, cooperation on that. That's why we see this equity fund as an urgency tool, an emergency tool that should be utilized this year. But of course, we will not envisage the existence of this tool in 5 years' time. So I think the emergency nature of this proposal is key. As the emergency nature of the recovery fund proposal will also be important.
But Simone, if I can add on this emergency aspect, I think this is actually very important. And I think the big difficulty the EU has is that EU decision-making is actually very slow and very complicated and very cumbersome. And that's why essentially the first line of defense are national institutions, and they have acted, and they have acted strongly. There is a Eurogroup decision to actually set up an equity type fund around the EIB, particularly with a focus on SMEs. But that discussion hasn't advanced as nicely as it should have. The hope is still, I think, that we get that instrument perhaps as of June. So that would be the first, in a sense, the first kind of equity instrument at the EU level, hopefully as of June. But I think we need to accelerate this equity instrument from the recovery fund to actually this year. It can't start only 21. It should ideally start this year. It should ideally go through the EIB, and it should happen quickly. If not, we will again in the next months by necessity have to rely on essentially national mechanisms.
Good.
Can I just add one comment, Giuseppe, on this, if I may?
Sure.
Because it is. I mean, I certainly agree that you need a good exit plan, also in view of the question that we got from a listener earlier on. But unfortunately, ex ante, it's easy to talk about clear exit plans, but ex post is very difficult to justify that. I remind you of ABN AMRO is still nationalized. The government has tried a couple of times to come to the markets and failed, simply because you don't want to sell at a place where you lose money. So, you know, the only way that you can help the taxpayer is not to involve them. Now, that, of course, is not correct because we are in an emergency. So if you're in an emergency, how you do that is crucial. But I think a principle I would add is that we need to involve the state only for very specific purposes and then provide certain legal certainty for the markets to pick up. And I think that's something that requires granular details. It's not just about principles, it's about how do you do that in a way that you can make an advancement.
Can I add on this point? I think, Maria, it's a very good point, the ABN AMRO point. I think it's important that we understand that interventions now into companies do not necessarily lead to profits. I mean, if a company has less value after this crisis, it might still be the right thing to sell that company because the purpose, the first principal purpose of intervening in the company now is not that the government makes a profit. If that was the first principle, you know, then private investors could just as well do the job. It is about supporting companies to get through this crisis and addressing the market failure that not enough funding of those companies is available. And so, yes, governments will make losses on some of these interventions. And that's okay. I mean, that's the reason why these interventions have to be done is that there are losses. So in that sense, I think even if you make a loss on ABN AMRO, it still probably makes sense to sell it. But I think you should be upfront that there might be losses on some. But I think you should also be upfront that current shareholders also have to take a hit, because if you get in and you know, the current shareholders just make the future profits and the government absorbs all the losses, I think it's unacceptable from a society point of view.
I have some questions from the audience I want to read. Annie Podimata from Greece, she's asking, relaxation of state aid rules is an issue of major concern. Competitiveness gap will deteriorate. She's wondering how much compatible this is with EU industrial strategy. On the other hand, Benedict from Siemens is asking, bringing innovation to the market could be a great element for recovery. Could the EU relax state aid rules for innovation funding? And he makes an example for more OPEX, OPEX funding, for example. This really shows a little bit and mirrors a little bit the discussion we are having. You know, these two sides are like a kind of two sides of the same coin, it seems to me.
If I may comment on this, because I think it's the first point we started with when you asked me about, you know, are we really are we really now going in a Europe which is a non-competitive Europe? And I think it's exactly right. There is the relaxation of the state aid rules was necessary. In my view, there is no doubt about that. We needed to do that. But in the process, we discover that there is an unfair playing field being encouraged. And therefore, as our viewer from Greece say, it will deteriorate the competitiveness playing field. Now, what should we do about that? I think Simone gave it a very, very, put it very nicely when they said you need to sort of compensate for it by bringing it back to the centralized European field and compensate for that. I think that's one way you could do it. But in the process, and here comes the question from Benedict, in the process, and while those rules are not as binding as they are normally, let's think a little bit about the industrial policy of Europe. We need to do that anyway. We wrote it in the memos to the new leadership back in the spring of last year. There is a need for thinking industrial policy in the context of EU's position in the world. And this is an important thing to do right now, why those state aid rules are not there binding.
I don't fundamentally disagree. I think the issue of industrial policy is a very, very complex issue. And I have some doubts that innovation is hindered by state aid, strict state aid rules. I think innovation and state aid rules are not incompatible at all. So I think this notion that now relaxing state aid rules finally removes the shackles of Brussels and companies can now become more innovative. I think that's a bit of a wrong notion. I think at the end of the day, competition within the single market is actually helpful for the productivity of firms. I mean, firms are productive because they compete against each other and they innovate against each other. And then, if they have a good business model and a good productivity story, they will get the funding necessary. I think the issue now at stake is really that in this pandemic, we have multiple market failures and funding in the pandemic is not as easily available, right? And there are credit constraints becoming binding, and the ECB bank lending survey shows this. So there's market failures. And at that stage, the relaxation of the state aid rules is actually important and is helpful. But I would be very careful to think that, relaxing state aid rules will give a huge boost to innovation. I think the bigger issue for me is much more the direction of the economy we want to take. I mean, we haven't talked much about this. Do we want to go into a green economy? Do we want to go into a digital economy? I mean, these are big societal directions. And one of the key arguments of our paper is that if you do not set those directions now, you will have no compass. You will not know which companies actually currently deserve rescuing and which do not deserve rescuing, because the profitability of any firm in the future depends on the kind of green deal that will be implemented, right? And so my worry is really that now a lot of in this trade-off between big societal goals and sort of short-term job preservation, a lot of money will just be put into short-term job preservation, the example of the car industry is a very good one, where now purchase premia are being discussed for old combustion engines. Well, that's great for the companies. It's not really great for the companies to create a new business model. It's not great for creating the economy of tomorrow. And by the way, it creates a capital stock all these cars that will make it impossible to achieve the climate goals by 2030. So I think we really need clear guidance now on the climate goals and on the societal goals. And then from that, decide which companies primarily deserve what kind of subsidies.
Exactly. On this, it's like fundamental. And recalling again the speech of the president of the Commission earlier on the plenary session of the European Parliament, she clearly mentioned the green goals and the digitalization innovation as two core principles of that should inform also this recovery. And giving the floor to Simone, I would like to, following the words of Guntram as well, maybe elaborate a little bit more. Coming back to the paper that we started with, what is suggested on this regard?
Well, coming back to the paper, I would like to switch a little bit the focus away from the equity story, which is important, but is only half of the story. The other half is the recovery plan.
Exactly.
Which is really what currently sit in Italy, everybody's waiting for this recovery plan to be announced because there are very high expectations about that. So I think that also for the politics behind the EU intervention overall, the recovery plan will be fundamental. Therefore, I think we should focus a little bit on that. I think our paper clearly outlines that we should use the European Green Deal and also the industrial policy, the EU industrial policy that was just unveiled before COVID kicked in, as the basis of the recovery plan. We don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel. We have done a lot of work in preparing, for example, the European Green Deal and trying to assess which could be in concretely the priorities to push, for example, energy efficiency in buildings, to push for the digitalization of the grid and so on and so forth. So there is a blueprint on which we should build. The question is how? And of course, let me go straight to the point. The question is whether the recovery fund will be mainly focused on grants or which will be the balance, basically, between loans, guarantees and grants. That's the core of the issue. And I think the European Parliament raised this point very strongly when in a resolution that was, I think, already voted yesterday, there was a motion of the European Parliament with a very clear point on the fact that a warning to the European Commission against financial wizardry, against mechanisms that basically seek to mobilize private investments with limited EU funding, given the fact that the additionality of such mechanisms, a la Juncker plan to be clear, have been questioned in the past. And there are questions whether such an initiative, such a financing scheme could work today in the current situation. So the Parliament is calling for a stronger role of grants. And in our view, that also a sensible way to go, because obviously grants provide more insurance, but if you have a strong component of grants, you will need a very strong central accountability at the EU level and control over how these expenses will be carried out, of course. The other point is concerning the European budget, because it's clear that if grants will have an important role, those will go through the European budget, because the European budget is a system through which grants are allocated at the EU level. I think President von der Leyen defined the European budget as the mothership of the European recovery after COVID. In our view, if this is the case, we need to consider how the budget is allocated, because we know very well that 70% of the budget is common agriculture policy and cohesion funds. Maybe there might be the case to revise how the budget is allocated in terms of resources and priorities. So the Green Deal and digitalization should go even higher in terms of prioritization. And the second element, and then I close, is how the resources are allocated, because clearly there will be the need to also allocate part of the resources to the regions that have been mostly hit by the health crisis and the consequent economic crisis as well.
So my next question, perhaps to Guntram, is that yes, okay, this is interesting, and definitely at each cycle of the budget, we have always a discussion about the prioritization of the different items and what should be up, what should be down, and obviously the common agricultural policy is always like putting on the battlefield in a way or another, and so on. But the question is here, how do we find more money? I mean, there is this issue about own resources that has been put into place, but there's also like the issue that if those grants needs to be meaningful for the tasks that needs to achieve, we probably have to multiply the actual budget of the Union itself. And how do we multiply the budget of the Union?
I think it's very clear that the EU budget can spend basically only on the basis of actual revenues coming in. And borrowed money can primarily be used for lending. I mean, that's the way the treaties more or less foresee this. There is now an intensive legal debate on whether one can tweak this and, you know, essentially get some of the borrowed money to actually spend it as grants. The precise legal limits of this are unclear to me. But I think it's, of course, in terms of the overall picture, I think it's clear that member states will have to agree on a larger EU budget if they want this budget to do more. So they need to. But I think politically, you can only get a larger budget if you also readdress the allocation of the budget. I mean, we cannot just claim everybody in society insists on his or her privileges, including the rich farmers, and then, you know, we double down and add to this without getting any cuts on the existing privileges. I think this will be not acceptable. So existing privileges will have to pay their share. But then I think, as I stated at the beginning, I think it's extremely important that we actually borrow significantly and that the EU borrows significantly to smooth the effects over time. And to do this, and that's the technical discussion, you essentially need a difference between spending and commitment in the EU budget. And my understanding is this difference is now being discussed to be around 0.5, perhaps even 0.7% of GDP. Now, if you do that for 7 years, which would be desirable, I think you can come up with a borrowing capacity of 600-700 billion euros. Now, then you need the political commitment to give that amount of essentially commitment. If you get less, your actual borrowing is going to be less, like 300-400 billion. And if it's a number like 300-400 billion actual borrowing, the macroeconomic effects are, of course, not so big. Then you enter much more into this territory of financial wizardry that Simone explained, which is not very. I mean, it's helpful, but it's not helpful enough. So you need actual real borrowing at the EU level. And for that, you need commitments of the member states to give bigger guarantees or bigger commitments to the EU budget, essentially.
Thank you. That's very clear. We are coming towards an end of this episode, so I would like to have a final round of reflections on the recovery plan, on the issues that we debated so far. What will be the takeaway of this discussion if we have to, not just summarize, but what is the takeaway from this and what is the next steps in this debate, which of course we're going to follow and we're going to continue to analyze.
If I may go first, I mean, basically two things. I think the size of the money, of the pot that we will be able to create will be constrained by our inability to modernize the MFF, as well as the friction between how many grants versus loans. If I was to wish something, I wish that the grants that are given, I mean, to the extent that we want to give grants, because we believe this is a good thing to do, that these grants go to the most productive firms, those that are in line with societal goals and those that are ready to go, because they will have a very big role to play once the economy comes out of the lockdown.
Well, I would like to maybe have a message of hope because today, sure, the EU unemployment mechanism has got its final yes. So we now have this mechanism, which we have discussed for a very long time. So 2 months ago, the mood also around that instrument was very different. Today, in 2 months, the situation has changed importantly and we have it. So I hope that the same kind of achievement could be made on the front of the recovery plan. So I really hope that in 2 months' time, we could reconvene and have a positive take also on that. The speed of this crisis is presenting a window of opportunity for Europe to reinvent itself and to abate barriers, political barriers that have blocked certain initiatives for a very long time. So I hope that starting with the joint borrowing that we were discussing before, we could really make substantial steps ahead also in this front.
Guntram, last word from your side.
No, I mean, I share the hope of Simone. Perhaps I'm too old to believe that the hopes will materialize. So I'm genuinely worried that we will do too little at the EU level in all the various dimensions, and that as a result, the European Union will actually get more fragile. That's my fear, but I do share the hope, and I think we all need to be clear and aware what is at stake. It's the single market's integrity that is certainly under huge pressure, but it's also the European macroeconomy, and it's also the capability and the functionality of major European institutions such as the European Central Bank that are currently under a lot of pressure. And so we really need to be bold and vigorous in our response, because the risks are very high, it seems to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Guntram, and thank you, Simone Maria, for this very interesting discussion, and thank you to our listeners for participating with their questions to this session of The Sound of Economic Lives. I would like to remind again that the paper of Guntram, Simone and Giulia, who is another co-author that was not present in the discussion, is available on our website www.bruegel.org, as well as the opinion piece from Maria that we also discussed in this episode, together with many other analyses of our experts. So thank you very much, and until next time, bye-bye.